Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG tonight in those dark hours and important hours of conflict. On the one side, a tyrant, a dictator, Vladimir Putin, and on the other, a bunch of Ukrainian neo-Nazis. I can already feel Richard being torn apart. Who will he root for? tough call. Hopefully tonight, though, we can convince him that there are good people on both sides. How are you doing, Richard?
Thank you for that introduction, I guess. Yes, I'm torn between a Asiatic dictator and a crazed band of neo-Nazi berserkers. Whom do I like more? Who is better? I don't know. Well, no, that's not, those two things don't really factor in my decision making on this matter, but I'm doing all right. I've had this lingering cold.
Oh,
I feel okay, but my throat, as probably your listeners can hear, is a little
all
bit,
right.
It's funny. I apparently still do not have COVID. I keep testing negative. Their take home test.
And that must be very hard to handle, not getting COVID when everyone has it. It's becoming a status display.
If anyone is justified in believing that COVID is a myth, it might very well be me.
You've been looking to get it and not getting it. Well, that's just a sign that the regular flu is continuing, despite the fact that the testing was abandoned for almost a year, and now we're back to just integrating the idea that there are many viruses going around the population every year, and it's a mix of all this. So the Ukraine situation continues to develop. The big convoy that is now 17 miles long is headed to Kiev, and the head of it is probably has probably already attained Kiev at this point. Kiev is now under heavy bombardment, and so it's time to talk to you about the situation and what's to take of it. You had an interesting take on Twitter that eventually these events will be good for a lot of people. It will be good for America. It will be good, yes, for reinstating a kind of order in the world that had been dissolved almost.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I don't know where to begin on this Ukraine question, because I don't want to just begin by saying this is going to be great, guys. They might think that I'm either a madman or I'm a Putin fanatic, or I am overly optimistic about Ukraine. I do think that Ukraine has a chance, and I would say that I think that this is going to be long and drawn out. I don't think this is going to be a quick strike decapitation. I think this is going to be a lot more difficult for Russia than perhaps they imagined. They might have imagined a decapitation and quick strike. This will be over in days, or a situation like Georgia in 2008, in which the world did not react in the way that it did over the past 3 days. And that they could have, in a way, gotten away with it, achieved strategic aims, and moved on. Where to begin? I would say this. I have been saying on Twitter and on Twitter Spaces, and I've also been saying this, you know, among my private colleagues, that I took this very seriously. There was a rumor in the air since December that was basically, this is a phony war. Nothing's going to happen. Why are you talking about this? Joe Biden wants to distract from COVID or some such conspiracy theory that, you know, the world just isn't a puppet show. I'm afraid to say it's actually pretty chaotic, and you have to examine various interests involved. I took it very seriously, and I made multiple predictions. I think basically saying, I think there is a very good chance that this is going to end up into being an invasion. And I also did not believe, as is evidenced in a discussion I did with Master Shake, who's an interesting guy from the Baltic regions, I did not believe that Putin would ever simply go in and offer humanitarian aid to the Donbass region as a kind of peacekeeper, but that he would go for it all. The reason why I have always believed that, the reason why I I took this seriously when there were rumors of an encampment on the border in December, is that retaking Ukraine, and that's the way that a Russian patriot and Vladimir Putin is one would think of it, bringing in this prodigal son back into the family is a vital interest to the Russian Empire, let's say, the Russian zone, its sphere of influence. Go ahead.
Very interesting, because there's a lot of talk about, if NATO takes over Ukraine, this is a launchpad for missiles toward Russia, which is true. But in the age of technology, does it matter that much? Because people seem to present the Putin move as being essentially just to protect Ukraine from being a NATO missile launch site. But in reality, the power of the US is probably... strong enough to send missiles across the planet the way whatever they want.
I think we might have two competing understandings of empire in the Anglo-American world and in the Russian world. And this might be explained with Carl Schmitt's concept of land and sea, or you could think of it as a kind of oceanic global merchant empire, true globalism, as it were. Which island nations like the UK, this is the way they think, the way we think. My name is Richard Spencer, after all. I've inherited these genes. I also inherited from my mother's side Prussian genes. So
that's why I was very excited talking to you. Because do you feel a kind of ethnic tie to what's happening right now, or do you feel it as an American?
I feel it as an American, and I feel like I am ultimately a Westerner. Eurasianism, however you want to define that, has never resonated with me. I grew up in the Cold War. I am not a traitor to my country. And I am, if this is the way that the world is descending into a Cold War encampment, which I think is true, then I will take the side of my people, period. And so... I have obviously ferocious criticisms of America and Western Europe and liberalism, et cetera. And I also have a respect and maybe even a sort of affection or romanticism about Russia. And I understand what Putin is doing. I do not think Putin is a madman. Now, he very well might be in ill health and, you know, power breeds madness. Okay, fine. But I actually respect what he is trying to achieve. I think he is trying to achieve rational goals that derive from his conception of a Russian sphere that absolutely includes Ukraine. They do not want as was in the Second World War, a German army crossing Ukraine towards the Caspian Sea. Ukraine obviously has huge, it has significant, I would say, strategic war resources. It has people, there's gas, and so on. There's famously an agricultural region. I mean, it is a plains region. There's obviously also a tragic and terrible history with Ukraine and Stalinism and kind of bringing Ukrainians into a fold. This coincided with, you know, serious famine and unbelievable loss of life. And Stalin was, you know, absolutely brutal as well. So there is absolutely a tragic history. But at the end of the day, Vladimir Putin understands Ukraine as geostrategic importance that cannot be overstated.
Absolutely.
He does not want German, American, or French, or British tanks crossing to the Caspian, encircling Russia and knocking it out. His goals are rational and reasonable. And maybe if Trump were more foresighted, he could have said, you know, oh, you know, let's get along with Russia. This is what I'm about. Maybe I'll build a Trump Tower in Moscow. That would be amazing. Miss Universe contest twice a year. If he had said, why don't we negotiate a neutralization of Ukraine? That is, Ukraine, maybe you could join the EU, maybe not, but we're going to take NATO off the table And thus that it, you would either be a neutral buffer zone, but I don't think a neutral buffer zone would suffice. I think Russia wants Ukraine as part of its strategic alliance. Now, is that possible? Of course it's possible. Plausible with Trump, who had no vision and no understanding? Sadly, no. It didn't happen. And here we are.
Absolutely.
But the fact is, we are here, and there is a major conflict going on. The world response is just unbelievable. I mean, Sweden has a seemingly ended neutrality. The Swiss banks have ended neutrality. I mean, Estonia is joining the club. I mean, Finland. I mean, oh my God.
But Switzerland had already been giving up its kind of shiny banks secrecy system for decades now. So I'm not surprised. Switzerland was on that path. But a lot of people are finding it funny that they stayed neutral in front of Adolf Hitler, but they can't stay neutral in front of Putin.
No comment, I guess.
All right. As a reminder, you can join us on Entropy and send super chats. There's already a lot of questions accumulating. Or you can send your super chats through Odyssey by clicking the support button. Unfortunately, though, we will not be able to accept super chats in rubles. Unfortunately, we would not be able to cash them out. So please send super chats in USD. The sanctions are hitting strong, and I don't want to be stuck with rubles in Canada, because I'm going to get Justin Trudeau after sending his anti-trucker police after me. So and by the way, our survey on Entropy is, what does Putin want? All of Ukraine, half of Ukraine, or just an end bridge to Crimea? What I find amazing in the communication of Putin is he always says, oh, we want this, and he takes more. You know, he made it look like he may have won just a paratrooper operation of decapitation, but he was also ready to send convoys of tanks. He made it look like, I just want to protect those republics from humanitarian concerns. And a day later, he was already on invasion plan. That's a beautiful strategic, from a military perspective. I mean, you can compliment him, I guess, for this kind of intelligence, to be always one step ahead.
Yes. It's a bit, I guess, a bit like the madman theory of international relations. Also, he is setting the agenda. Putin has changed the world. There's no question by taking these actions. And in some ways, the response has changed the world. You know, the prime minister of Germany, Scholz, his response of upping the German military, sending aggressive weaponry to Ukraine, something that Germany hasn't really done since 1945. That has changed the trajectory of that nation, for better and for worse. So absolutely. He is setting the agenda. In terms of what does he want, I do think that he ultimately wants all of Ukraine in the Russian sphere. The secure, you know, whether you can understand that as like a NATO-like organization, a security zone, a Russian cultural zone. There's good reason for Ukraine to be in the Russian cultural zone. I mean, to be frank, in terms of history and genes and culture and religion, although that's a little bit tricky. He wants that in the zone. My prediction is that we're going to see, Putin has bitten off a little bit more than he can chew. I don't think he factored in this degree of a Western response. This is going to be difficult. An insurgency can be funded and armed by the West and by NATO nations. I imagine what might happen, and I don't think this is really the worst case scenario, is that Ukraine ends up in a German-like situation. That is a divided country that is kind of neutralized or divided, one half in NATO, one half in the Soviet zone. Maybe it's a neutral company with kind of a Russian sphere and a NATO sphere. I don't know exactly how it's going to go down. However, we've seen this before, and you know, past is preface, or, you know, history is a guide to what we might see in the future. So that's kind of how I see this shaking out. I think we'll see if Russia, what it can achieve in terms of in the next 48 hours about, sieging and then perhaps even assaulting Kiev. But yeah, we'll see.
It's a matter of a couple of days, as you say, 48 hours, because then the insurgency will be fully supported and funded to the extent that they're capable of. It's all a matter of delivery. Can the insurgency be fed into Kiev? At this point, I'm doubting, because I think that Putin's web is spreading across Kiev, and there won't be an insurgency left to fund, and there won't be access to roads, and perhaps air will be neutralized. I think one of the aspects that Putin didn't fully control is air control. The bombardments of the airports at the beginning were spectacular and they were massive, but it seems that the air systems of the Ukrainian army are not fully under control, and therefore they can keep receiving deliveries at this point. And the problem is the problem of the infinite source of money. If Europe and America are in to say we're going to keep an insurgency going forever, it will last forever as long as there are Ukrainians alive.
Right. And I don't think the West wants an endless insurgency like what we faced in Iraq. These are different situations. Ukraine isn't a quagmire like, say, Afghanistan was for the Soviet Union, famously, and was for the United States, equally famously. It's a very different situation. It's not just at Russia's doorstep. It is part of Russian nationalist or imperialist conception of their strategic zone. So it's just very different than a foreign quagmire. So I don't think. Again, maybe I'm being hopelessly optimistic. I don't think the West really wants, or anyone wants, some just like 5-year long bloodbath with Ukrainian jihadists, you know, blowing themselves up. I don't think that. I think this will be very bad. And then some kind of solution will be reached with a division of the country. That's just my prediction. I might very well be wrong. Putin very well might lose this war. I mean, look, there is so much disinformation out there. So many of the videos that you see are from 2014. Yeah. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ghost of Kiev thing was a lie. The Snake Island martyrs might be based on fact, but is dubious. I mean, you have to just take a step back, even if, you know, or especially perhaps if the mainstream media, reports on something, you got to be like, all right, you know, take everything with a heaping of salt. And, but you know, I don't know. I'm not buying really any of it. And
I'm quite impressed
just kind of looking at the big factors.
By how Ukrainian nationalism became sexy all of a sudden. We even had Facebook allow temporarily the praise of Ukrainian neo-Nazis, playing totally in the hand of Putin by doing so, essentially saying, well, when the far right defends a country for real against aggression of someone we hate, then suddenly it's okay to praise them, even if they're far right. It's quite fascinating to see the leftist of Twitter fawn over something like the ghost of Kiev or that kind of stuff. It's warmongering by a bunch of liberals. What is there to say about, first, this information war going on the internet, and second, the response of European and US countries, which to me is very passive aggressive. It's all, oh, we're going to send so much support, so much weapon, but no soldiers. It's kind of a mixed message, and it's very feminine in its approach. Is Vladimir Putin the last man, you know, who's leading an actual physical war, and for that he will win?
I definitely see what you're suggesting there. There is a kind of passive aggressive approach of you know, like, well, we're going to send weapons, but we're not going there, but you will have no money. So yeah, I can.
It's cancel culture. It's cancel culture and exported.
Yes. RT will be off YouTube. So I don't know, go to BitChute or someplace with the QAnon people. Users. Yeah, I see. I definitely can see that. Although, in fairness, this is why something like NATO is a real thing. NATO has had an identity crisis since 1991. What do we do with this thing? We've got this Ferrari in our garage. It cost a lot of money to upkeep. So what do we do with it? And Bill Clinton decided to ride it around in the Balkans. There's just a lot of serious questions of what do you use a Cold War alliance created in the 1940s, directed explicitly and unequivocally at the Soviet Union. What do you do with this thing? Now it actually has meaning, and it always had meaning. It was just kind of dormant. Now it has real meaning. Ukraine was never a part of NATO. Russia and Vladimir Putin was very clear about this, you know, in no uncertain terms, that will never happen. I mean, I think Russia is willing to go there. I mean, I don't think the elevated nuclear level is a joke. Ukraine, you know, this strategically important and culturally important part of Russia and their conception can never, ever be a part of NATO. I mean, that is very real. That's, again, why my calculus leads me to believe that a German solution will be achieved. Interesting note. Actually, people forget about this. There were documents revealed that suggested that Beria, who came after Stalin and is known quite accurately, apparently, as an absolute maniac and rapist and murderer and so on, was actually willing to neutralize and reunite all of Germany. And what he talked about was an Austrian solution for Germany. This offer was rebuffed by Konrad Adenauer, who effectively wanted a West German sphere because he saw that as is in his strategic and cultural, in fact, interest. He didn't want the Protestant Prussian, or in his mind, Asiatic, effectively, East Germans in his country. And he wanted a Roman Catholic Germany, not a Martin Luther or Adolf Hitler Germany. And he kind of liked the West as it was. And he obviously was working with America quite well, working with France quite well. So it's an interesting situation where one of the, you know, the butchers of the Soviet Union was actually very reasonable towards a country that he was at war at, you know, a decade or so previously. Interesting tidbit.
The parallels with the genesis of Germany itself are profound. We had a Western Germany that was more like Western European, and we had an Eastern Germany that was more a culture of warrior and conquerance. And in a way, you have this in Ukraine today with a kind of metropolitan elite, in the West up to Kyiv, and in the East you have a population of ethnic Russians, and there is tension. What is there to say about what has been happening in Ukraine for the last, well, down to 2004? Do you think that there's been an oppression of ethnic Russians that has been going on? Do you think that there is some justification in perceiving their overtake of the country as being essentially stolen Ukraine from the ethnic Russians and depriving them of positions in the bureaucracy, that kind of stuff?
Yes, I think there's actually reason to believe that that was going on. So in 1991, all of Ukraine, including Crimea, voted for independence. So again, there was a, with the collapse of the Soviet sphere, there was just, you know, chaos, and there are things that happen like a referendum of, do you want to be a part of a country or not? And so there was legitimacy for Ukrainian nationalness and statehood. There's also, as I've mentioned many times, just a huge overlap between Russian and Ukrainian culture. In 2004, there was the so-called Orange Revolution, which was fiercely opposed by Russia and its then President Yanukovych, President of Ukraine, that is. And supported by the West, we kind of saw a first stage of the Maidan. 10 years later, we had the Maidan, which wasn't at all to this degree, but it was very similar. You know, people posting stuff on social media, getting excited about the Ukrainian people rising up against authoritarianism or something, and knowing very little about the situation or understanding it, just kind of, you know, like posting a BLM flag or a gay flag or whatever. So that was also a time that led to basically these, you know, separatist regions in the Donbass separating, that led to the annexing of Crimea. Now, of course, Russia already had its military in Crimea, so it was there. And then also there was a response to that, which I think, you know, any fair-minded person could see as unjust. Banning of the Russian language, you know, a certain kind of Ukrainian nepotism, if you want to call it that, and in promotion. I mean, it's a real thing. In terms of there was a humanitarian catastrophe in the Donbass region. Now, here again, we face the fog of war. Is everything that you hear and see about things like crucifixion or killing of babies, should we believe all of these things? You know, in World War I, they were claiming Germans were bayoneting babies in Belgium, I believe. You have war is the just original fake news, you know, source. I mean, like, this is not actually like the ghost of Kiev is just typical of war. It's not some new social media phenomenon or something. This is how wars have been going on since the Bronze Age, is fake news, basically. What was it? One of the Rothschilds, I think what he did was he put out rumors in London that Napoleon had been victorious at Waterloo, and there was a crash of the pound, and then he swooped in and bought up, something like that. Maybe it's apocryphal, but the fact is you can whisper something in someone's ear or show them an image on Twitter, some 2014 image or some doctored photo, and they're like, oh my God, you know, Russians did this, Ukrainians did this, Russians are going to win, Ukrainians are going to win. You just have to just block it out, basically.
It's fascinating to see the computerization of this tradition, because essentially Twitter is this kind of automated fake news machine that you would have had to print pamphlets and drop them in plain over populations before. Right. Now you have them on screen and you can directly interface with their brain.
Right. Wasn't Germans were dropping pamphlets to soldiers in America?
Has been doing this, for example, to Japan, to warn them that there would be a nuclear strikes, to scare them. I'm pretty sure Germans have been doing it to French people.
I believe the Germans dropped pamphlets to African-American soldiers saying that, you know, your treatment at the hand of the Southern racist is intolerable and, you know, only we understand you. Just weird propaganda, like, you know, mind fucks, you know, kind of like, I guess Putin claiming he wants to denazify the Jewish prime minister.
Yeah, what is there to say about this? Weird. I mean, I find it strategically very interesting, this Putin statement, because in the end, who would take the side of the Nazis? But it's kind of pushed to the extreme. I know that in the West, everyone is a Nazi, and so you don't take much of a risk by calling a white person a Nazi in the left. But Putin is pushing it to the extreme. I don't know if the left can sustain that much white supremacy assignment.
Well, it's true. I mean, obviously, it went over like a lead balloon in the West. No, everyone just rolled their eyes. And so as propaganda for your enemies, it failed utterly. But I think it probably goes deeper. I mean, I mentioned this on Twitter. I was like, the sovereign is he who says who the Nazi is. So like whoever is a sovereign ruler gets to declare who the Nazis are, you know? And so, you know, like if you're a sovereign ruler in the West, you look at literal Nazis in the Azov battalion or whatever, and you're just kind of like, well, let's not talk about that, you know, basically. But you're like, oh, Putin, he's a lot like Hitler. So you get to kind of declare him to be the Nazi. Putin is doing the same. He is basically saying, we are liberating this country. We are denazifying it. They are claiming they're Nazis is basically just saying like they're worse than the devil. You know, they have no humanity. We're going to denazify them, clean them out. I think there might even be a deeper level that someone mentioned in a response, which was that a lot of the Soviet legitimacy of communism came from doing the fighting and dying in the Second World War. I mean, remember, America entered very, very late, much like the First World War. It was the Eastern Front where the action was. And that's how the war was won. As the, you know, promise of global communist revolution faded, I think a lot of the legitimacy of communism came from, well, after all, we defeated the Nazis. I mean, Britain just survived. America came in late, and they were giving some guns to the Soviet Union, but you know, they didn't do the dying. What is it? 200,000 Americans lost their lives. 20 to 30 million Russians. I mean, this is not comparable. Mm-hmm. And so, a lot of the legitimacy of the Soviet state was we defeated the Nazis, and I think Putin is kind of calling upon that. But again, it's a negative legitimacy. It's we are not Hitler, which is very similar to the legitimacy of Western leaders, where they're like, oh, we can't go down that road. You know, hate is wrong, blah, blah, blah. It's liberals, and Putin is one, kind of have struggled to define themselves outside of we are not the devil.
I had a vision when he said we're going to denazify Ukraine. The year is 2050. The Russian Empire rules over the entire planet, and there are museums everywhere talking about the Ukrainian anti-Russian Holocaust, because there's going to be war prisoners, you know, the people they call saboteurs, and they torture them, they keep them in prison, and they kill some of them. They're saboteurs by the mere fact of being ethnically Russian, being caught behind the lines of the Ukrainian. And there's not much due process being given to them being declared saboteurs. I'm suspecting right now that some amount of genocide activity is going on in Kiev. And that when they say we killed 3,000, 4,000 Russian soldiers, I think that there may be some persecution happening there, and that they may not all be Russian soldiers on the papers. And you can totally think, if Russians are the victor of this conflict, going forward, there will be stories that will sound like the bells of the Holocaust. And they will tell the stories of these soldiers that were captured, tortured, and that stayed alive to tell the story later.
I completely agree.
That's
a
great
kind of winner's right history situation.
Yeah.
It's very true.
And then what's making me uncomfortable is this genocide could be happening right now. And what we have are like blue haired feminists cheering on Twitter. Haha, we caught the so saboteurs. True. Yeah, go ahead, Ghost of Kiev. I mean, I would look back at this in 50 years from now and say these people were insane. Nothing, just like I would look back at World War II and saying that there were some people insane in there.
Everything you say is true. But you've got to pick a side sometimes.
Yeah. And so the question is, who will be the victor? Because there's another scenario in which in 2050, Putin doesn't exist, Russia doesn't exist, and it's been integrated to a worldwide NATO empire.
I think, you know, yes. I mean, I think, in a way, a better solution that I'm kind of calling for is a new Cold War. I think there needs to be global enmity and otherness in the world. And I think that's a good thing. The West is obviously, Putin is right, we are decadent to the core. It's flowing in our blood. We are seeking our own destruction and kind of deconstructing, you know, sexual, racial, parental identity. I mean, we are doing it. He is correct when he says it's an empire of lies. My view, and granted, you know, I'm a Nietzschean who believes that, you know, any war can sanctify, a great war can sanctify any cause. We need global enmity on a global scale in order to redefine ourselves and our consciousness. And we need to start thinking about what does it actually mean to be in the West? Does it mean that you own an iPhone? Does it mean that you're a feminist? Does it mean that you like gays or whatever? No, there actually is something else beyond that that mm-hmm. defines us as Westerners, much as Russia is seeking, however problematically, to define Russianness in this way. And so I do think this is a good thing. And ultimately, and I certainly don't want there to be casualties on either side, but I just look at it as it is. And I think this could be engaging in wishful thinking, perhaps a kind of turning point where there is a greater level of conservatism and identitarianism due to this enemy across the continent. And that's my hope. Mm-hmm. And so there I am. But the other thing about it is this is also very serious. This isn't a joke. One of the things that I've noticed, now we've talked about fake news and war go hand in hand. So we've talked about, you know, you can't get distracted by little tidbits you see online, lies. But that being said, I have been amazed at some of the conservatives who their at least initial response is that this doesn't exist. This is Biden's way of distracting you or something. I mean, it's InfoWars, just lunacy. It's real. It's a real thing. What is happening? Take it seriously. Now, obviously don't take it overly seriously, but take it seriously. But this is a real thing. This is a real division. This is a cold war. You cannot get on the wrong side of this.
And this is where it's
you can
fascinating.
Take that and where you will. Just saying, if we are in a cold war, and I think we are, traitors get persecuted and prosecuted and jailed. Just saying that. But beyond that, you can take mine. I mean, I'm not saying this. I'm not taking the side of the West out of cowardliness. I am part of the West. This is who I am. I'm on our team. But beyond that, you just can't get on the wrong side of a conflict this enormous, which I think it is.
It's fascinating to see those center-right conservative types who have been accumulating some kind of attention in the last year or 2 years. They are absolutely uninsightful. They don't understand what's going on. They're like, oh yeah, well, Ukraine, it's outside of America, and I don't know. They don't understand.
J.D. Vance? Like, I don't care about something halfway around the world. Yeah. I care more about my mama. Yeah, it's like, dude, shut up. You know, yeah. you want to be a senator in a country that founded NATO, okay? That's the reality of the situation, JD, all right? You're going to have to deal with this situation. Now, you could deal with it with more realism, with more diplomacy. Oh, let's try to see eye to eye with Putin. We don't need, let's avoid catastrophe. That's all good. But just this like knee-jerk, I don't give a fuck, is just stupid. And yeah. Again, look, Putin memes are funny. Shirtless man riding a bear or doing judo. That's all fun and games. Chanting Putin, Putin, Putin. That's not a good look. You kind of look like a insurrectionist. Let's just say that.
What is that term? A mix of insurrectionist and something. Okay, I thought you had mixed insurrectionist with incel or something.
Oh, an incel-rectionist, yes.
Where are the incels standing in the Ukraine conflict? We have no idea. I would have to go to Reddit and see where the
incels... sure they take the side of Russia, or like Chechnyans storming Kiev and like rounding up feminists and saying, you know, take off your shoes and make me a sandwich or death or something like that.
I've actually saw some speculation that there would be white migration of refugees and that this could result in a state-imposed waifu situation where there's so many women being... so many women getting out of Ukraine and the men are stuck in there. Is this all the fault of America? The situation we're in, has it been caused by America? There's been talk that Donald Trump himself had said to Putin, if you take Ukraine, I will level Moscow. And essentially Putin waited for, he would have said this privately to Putin and Putin would have said, what? And it seems that Putin waited for Donald Trump to go out of the presidency and take it.
That's a good question. Now, is that a credible report or is that just...
It was from mainstream media. I can search for it to confirm, but Moscow, Putin... If you take Ukraine, I will level Moscow. Yeah, there's a NewYorkPost.com article about it. Trump claims Putin would not have invaded Ukraine on his watch. So I don't know to which extent it's trustable, but clearly, whether Trump said this or not, the fact is Trump had this madman aura to him. And this could have weighed on Vladimir Putin's mind.
It's a good question. I mean, I saw a poll where 60% of the country thinks that this wouldn't have happened under Trump or something like that. I just, it's hard for me to answer that question, to be honest, because I think sometimes, you know, we like to say, you know, what is it? A correlation is not causation. And I think a lot of the American public, you know, it's like they'll blame coronavirus on Trump or something and then think that Biden has done better, even though actually there have been more deaths, you know, under Biden. I mean, it's just they kind of think like the president, it's almost like a primitive way of thinking, you know, where it's like a stranger comes to town and then the crops die and so we kill the stranger. You know, it's that type of thinking. I don't know. And I just think it's kind of an unserious thing. Now, if Trump claimed that to the New York Post, then that and a, you know, $350 will buy you a macchiato at Starbucks. I mean, that it's just, I don't even know what to make of it. Clearly there was interest in Moscow in having Trump as president. And I don't want to get over, I don't want to exaggerate the whole Russiagate stuff, but it's just, like they clearly were on his team and there was some degree of collaboration, whether it be through the internet research agency, hacking, handing stuff to Julian Assange, you know, even if it's merely like just dumb fake Facebook profiles that, you know, boomer housewives were sending to each other. On they clearly saw Trump in their interest. In 2016, they got real goods from that. In the Republican platform, there was a removal of weapon aid. I believe this is correct. If not, I can be corrected. I believe they removed weapons aid to Ukraine, and they claimed that it was more general aid, so you could send them foodstuffs, but not, you know, anti-tank missiles or whatever. They were getting real things. Now, you can also flip this around. A lot of the sanctions that have been posed due to the Nord Stream pipeline were actually lifted by Biden. Biden was playing diplomat. So it's a complicated thing, but I think overall Russia was on Team Trump. And so, you know, I don't know. I just don't know really what to make of this yet, of whether Trump would have done nothing. I do think this was, at least in some degree, this was the West's fault in the sense that the West, sane people in the West, could have recognized the strategic and cultural importance that Ukraine is to Russia. And they could have nipped it in the bud or gotten out in front of it and said, okay, we're actually going to neutralize the situation. Ukraine, you can be a member of the EU, but never NATO or something like that. Like you're going to be westernized, but strategically you will not be westernized. Interesting option that could have been, I mean, if I were a diplomat, that's something I would do, but I'm not a diplomat. And instead people like Samantha Powers are diplomats. So it's just, you know, I don't know. It could have been avoided. I would say that whether it's the West's fault, I mean, keep in mind, there's a, you know, you can't to blame NATO for this. I mean, it's like NATO originated as an anti-Russian alliance. So to claim that, I mean, I saw someone tweet out like, NATO has treated Russia like the government treats white people or something like and it's like, okay, that's an interesting analogy. Maybe it's kind of true, but it's like asking a bear not to like honey or something. It's just like NATO is an anti-Russian alliance. What do you expect from it? I mean, it, yes, could, it can be sane and realistic, but it's never going to be pro-Russia.
Absolutely. And that's a sad thing, because I don't see why. I don't see why we are so much in a opposition to Russia. Just to specify the reference of my earlier claim, the original claim comes from Michael Goodwin from the New York Post. Donald Trump told Vladimir Putin he would order the bombing of Moscow if Russia attacked Ukraine. If you move against Ukraine while I'm president, Trump allegedly said, I will hit Moscow. All those beautiful golden turrets will be blown up. We see the real estate guy in Trump right here.
Horrible, in a horrible way, yeah. Like, I wanted to build a Trump Tower. If there's anything worse than a Trump Tower in Moscow, it would be a nuclear attack on Moscow.
Yes. Oh, Keith Woods is in the chat. He sends 100 LBC. Thank you so much. Oh, sorry.
Hold on one second. I'm going to get some water in my throat.
Oh, yeah. I'll be reading some super chats. Keith Woods sends 100 LBC. He says, good show. Using this LBC to shamelessly plug that I will be hosting a debate between Richard and Joel Davis on my Odyssey channel this Sunday, 4 p.m. Eastern time. Very interesting. Well, people should be there. I'll be there. I like Keith Woods, although he's a little bit woo-woo and out there on his positions on idealism. I still enjoy the guy. And so would it be on Odyssey or, yeah, Odyssey channel? So Richard.
Yeah, I think it's going to be on Keith's Odyssey channel. Yeah.
Very nice. Yes, Keith's Odyssey channel. This amazing. I'll be following this. The optimistic pessimist says, Richard, can you discuss your book publications, particularly Dutton's book on race? Also, can you address the people who claim you are a Fed because you haven't been kicked off Twitter? Well, we've asked this question before to Richard, and it's not a super interesting subject, but about the books?
The question is, which federal agency am I working for? You all think that I am some white nationalist in the decadent West, whereas I have been delivering information to Mother Russia the whole time. Sorry, that was a terrible accent.
Not so bad.
I hope Russians take that in the spirit in which it was given. I'm just joking around. Okay, the books. Yeah. So Race, Making Sense of Race by Ed Dutton is out there. That's been the best-selling book I've ever published. It's really good. I imagine that a lot of people who are buying it probably know a lot of the stuff. They've heard, you know, about racial differences and IQ and all that kind of stuff. And that stuff is in there. But I think what they might be interested in is that, you know, 80% of the book is actually a lot of different stuff. So he goes into ethnicity, race, and religion. He goes into ethnogenesis, that is the creation of new races. He goes into race and the Jews, interesting chapter. There's just a lot in there that's very good. Race and personality differences, and psychopathy, schizoid tendencies, left-handedness, among other things, narcissism, differences in race. Yes. I felt like we didn't really have this book. So I worked with that very hard in this one. Also, we're at the completion stages of a book that I'll announce soon. It'll probably be available maybe in kind of mid-April or maybe May 1st or something like that, but it's called Spiteful Mutants. And, a lot of the essays, you guys might've noticed we published essays online about QAnon, BLM, SJWs. We've kind of been working up to this. And so it's a full book on basically the decline of child mortality and a dysgenic trend that has resulted from post-industrial living standards, 1% child mortality, total dysgenic breeding, and too much, you know, safe medicine, and the kind of effects that that can have in politics. So there's a whole book on Spiteful Mutants.
Okay, I was lifting my eyes to the sky because it's a term I don't like. I think it's misleading. You know, the concept of dysgenie, you have to be very careful about it, because what is interpreted as dysgenie very often, dysgenic changes, are actually eugenic changes in a direction you don't like. You have to be separating your moral preferences, because the fact is, leftists somehow are genetically fit to live in current society. Now, you can imagine a world like a jungle of anarcho-primitivism where they're not good there, but and there you say they are dysgenic because they wouldn't survive there. But the fact is, they are naturally selected to live in the societies that we currently live in, which are leftist dominant.
This is a very good point. And I hope you have him on to have this discussion, because I think I can see that there obviously is a conservative bias with Ed, which he acknowledges.
Yeah.
And I think you could kind of press back on him. I think that would be a good discussion.
Awesome. I'll invite him. Alt Media sends a super chat. He says, Richard, please end the fight between TRS guys and Andrew Anglin. We need to unite now more than ever. Stopping fights like this is a hobby for a woman, right?
Yeah, I'm unable and uninterested in stopping that fight. I was not aware that it was still going on. Just this whole uniting everyone, I think it was tried and failed, and I'm just not interested in that anymore.
Absolutely. Sprocket says, Richard, is the invasion of Ukraine the beginning of the end of Putin's rule? Will the alt-right have their hearts broken again, this time by Putin, as they had before by Trump, once they realize his 4D chess moves amount to nothing, even for Russia?
That is a very serious possibility. And I discussed that with Ed yesterday, I guess, or the day before. It was yesterday. Wow. Time just...
It's hard at this to point, it's like 24/7 news on the war, and we lose track of time.
I do. There's been a lot of very good spaces on the spaces have kind of come into their own during the Ukraine crisis. And there are a lot of people who actually do have real expertise who are talking about the war on spaces. It's a very casual way of doing things. So
yes.
You get smart people who otherwise wouldn't broadcast. Yeah, I mean, I think it would happen as a kind of palace coup. I don't think it would happen as the Russian people rising up against Putin. Although that might happen if the economic situation really deteriorates or if there's something like hyperinflation. But I think it is a real possibility now, whereas it wasn't a week ago. From what I understand from people as well, I mean, there's a kind of dysgenic quality, and you could fire back at me with the same critique, to the Russian elite, in the sense that you play ball and we like you and you make lots of money and you live long time. You are a contrarian, you're a little too ambitious, you're bringing up too many criticisms, boom, you're either exiled to the West or maybe worse.
Yeah.
And so there is a lot of sycophancy surrounding Putin and surrounding oligarchs. Remember all of those speeches where Putin is in this palatial room announcing, you know, humanitarian aid to Donbass. He's sitting among billionaires, and he is one. He is a $100 million yacht, by the way. So this is not just a public servant. And, you know, you have to play ball to be a part of this resource state that relies on state monopolies as the basis of its economy of natural resources, which is extracts from the ground. So it could happen. If they feel like he is ruining a good thing, they could gang up on him. There's clearly some tension between Putin and some of his people. I mean, I think that was made clear in the video that they published themselves. Putin was admonishing one of the oligarchs. So it's a tricky situation. I don't even want to speculate about like palace intrigue in Moscow right now, but I would say that it stands to reason that that's in the cards now, whereas a week ago it wasn't in the cards.
Yeah, what could happen is a missile strike, boom, on the head of Putin by America, and America would decide a kind of replacement strategy. That's what I'm most scared about. I hope Putin is taking protections. Boot on Face says Putin has defeated the Russian central bank that had a thumb on him like the Fed does ours. Crypto to full glory. I'm not aware of the situation with the Russian central bank. I had
Central
assumed
Bank
that.
has been sanctioned.
Yeah,
So
I know
this
it. I
is
know they've been sanctioned, but I'm not aware that there would be a conflictual entity to Putin.
Well, I don't know. I mean, this sounds like one of these a bit of a tinfoil hat type of person, but you know, certainly the central bank has power, and I guess what they're saying is that he's kind of done a judo move where the central bank has been sanctioned. America, you know, again, an attack on a central bank is really serious. I mean, this is not just like we're gonna freeze the assets of a billionaire who's Putin's right-hand man. This is you're attacking the economy itself, maybe even creating hyperinflation if you're freezing assets that the West can freeze. But yeah, but now he's free to do what? I mean, I don't know. That just seems a bit nutty. It's funny. I think I retweeted this. The crypto people before and at the origin of crypto Bitcoin, they're like, this is anti-government. Like, we don't need any governments. Like, we're beyond that now. It's kind of like the early internet where it's like the internet has no borders or nationalities or whatever. And then now they're like, we can support Russia through crypto. It's kind of like, which one is it? I mean, are you radical Austrian economist or are you Russian imperialist? Like, you kind of got to pick one. Like, those are pretty incompatible from what I
We
can
think
tell.
That a great product will attract both people. The Austrian economics will at time buy some Bitcoin, and then at some point the Russian imperialist will. Pam
Stupid
sends
enemy.
a super chat and she says, "Do you think that after Ukraine, Putin will try to invade the Baltic countries?"
I don't think he would try to invade the Baltic countries. I mean, the Baltic countries are Protestant, for one thing, with maybe an exception or two there. It doesn't have that cultural force that bringing in fellow Slavs and fellow mostly Orthodox Christians. There are some Catholics in Ukraine. I don't see that. I mean, you of course could take a perspective that Putin is just a expansionist madman, and if he were allowed to get away with this, he would just keep rolling. I don't buy that. I don't think that's his. Maybe that's true, but I think 99% of the chance is that he's actually a rational actor who has understandable goals.
Yeah, he's been dominating places that were Muslim before, so I'm thinking perhaps he's not that attached to religion and more attached to territorial economic considerations. Al
Sure.
sends $20. Thank you so much. He says, "Richard, I know there is a history of animal right and conservationism among eugenicists. Why is that? They seem to be two opposed viewpoints. A eugenicist wants to create a higher being, while the conservationist wants to conserve what is. What am I missing? Also, is there a Nietzschean argument for animal rights? Thanks." Well, those are interesting considerations. I think that ultimately, it's not because you're a eugenist that you have a conception of a perfect race that is the only thing attainable. I think there's lots of overlap that can be possible with natural views of the world and eugenic views. You can see nature not as attaining one specific goal, but you can see the very fact that nature plays out and that the forces are equilibrated to improve people. This could be attractive both to a conservationist and a eugenicist, but I'll let Richard answer.
Yes, very interesting question. Madison Grant, of course, is a famous eugenicist and the father of conservationism, really. He had a hand in founding Glacier National Park, the Redwoods. He saved many, many different species. He had a hand in founding the Bronx Zoo. I mean, he was absolutely a tree hugger, you could say. He was also a eugenicist. Now, his conception of eugenics in America was conserving the Anglo-Saxon race, basically. So it was a and almost a kind of conservation effort on humans. I don't think from him you wouldn't hear this kind of heady talk of like, we're going to create a master race or so on. I think you hear more talk of, we want to preserve the people who founded this country. And even in his discussion of conquest of the continent, there's a lot of tragedy in the conquest of the continent. There were people just bulldozing the continent. That was part of the conquest. So he had a kind of critical appreciation, you could say, of the people that he wanted to conserve. Mm-hmm. So they have gone hand in hand. Now, obviously, full-blown Nietzscheanism. It's interesting. You know, someone like Zarathustra, though he rejects pity, he does have a certain human quality to him. He would be a man, if there's a tightrope walker who falls off a tightrope, he would comfort that tightrope walker and say, you have excelled at your profession. You made danger your profession and you've died from it, but you've become yourself. So, you know, you have a good death. So there is a certain gentleness to Nietzsche in this sense. On the other hand, yes, Nietzsche wanted to create an Übermensch, which is a post-human being. I mean, he absolutely wanted to move beyond the human condition over the horizon into a new type of man. So, you know, on some level, it's kind of like we're leaving the human race in the dust, and we're a bridge to a higher species. So, you know, there is that kind of dynamic, you know, maybe even like demonic quality to what Nietzsche was saying.
I'm not an expert on Nietzsche, but I've heard a view that this Übermensch thing is overblown, and that Nietzsche was just talking about a man who would be honest in his debating tactics, like kind of a super intellectual, a man who would approach honesty in a different way than the self-interested man. It's bigger than that?
I think it's wrong to say that Nietzsche envisioned Hitler or something like that. Mm-hmm. Nietzsche, like, who is the Übermensch? Is it Napoleon, who Nietzsche had very, you know, he was infatuated with Napoleon. He had, you know, great things to say about him. Is it Napoleon? Is it Hitler, who, of course, Nietzsche never knew? He died in 1900. No, I think that's wrong. I don't think he wanted just a great dictator. I think he wanted something in some ways more disturbing and radical. And that is a leaving the human race in the dust, a new species of man. I think it's to say that he just wanted honesty, I think is a bit of a whitewashing. What he is saying, although he says it cryptically, and you have to be able to read well to see this, but he is saying something extremely disturbing and challenging.
Okay. Go Away says, does Richard support U.S. hegemony and a unipolar world? And if so, why? Also, does Richard see Russia or China as a greater threat to global stability?
Okay. No, the unipolar moment lasted, some people say it lasted from 1991 to 2001. That was the kind of end of history, two decades of, we don't have any more enemies. You know, what do we do? We're all going to be happy and all be Americans, basically, consuming liberals. And I think I would probably say that there was a unipolar moment in 1991 that lasted until 2021, December 2021, when we knew that this was taking place. Mm-hmm. And that was a point where, yes, there were other major players in the geopolitical stage. Of course there were. And Russia was one. China was a growing one. But there was a kind of unipolar force centered in Washington determining the show. I think that is over. Certainly China, even if it almost doesn't want to, it is going to have to step up to the stage. And China also, if we want to talk about a possible world war, I mean, you know, Russia has its eyes on Ukraine. China has its eyes on Taiwan. These things are kind of intermeshed. I mean, you know, which side are they going to take? We don't know. I mean, this could, you know, have a kind of cascading effect like the First World War. But I think the main thing is that there's going to be a kind of bifurcation or maybe trifurcation of the world where there are going to be competing systems. If the West fully, you know, goes through with its, this kind of level of sanctions, Russia is going to be on an island. You know, Russia, what is in the sanctions, you can still buy diamonds from Belgium and Gucci handbags from Italy or something. Like there's some like few luxury items that like pass through the sanctions or whatever. But overall, there's going to be a just total stark differentiation, two different economies. How China fits in that, I don't quite know yet. No one knows.
It's fascinating because we're already seeing...
Unipolar moment's over.
Yeah, we're already seeing the trifurcation you're talking about just in the releases of the press releases of governments like China, India, that are not fully condemning Putin in the same way the West would. And that's very interesting because you think, what if China takes Taiwan tomorrow morning? Does Joe Biden cut China out? Does the canceling that he's done with Putin, does he try to do it with China? Because that seems impossible.
Well, right. I mean, Russia supplies, you know, let's say 40 to 50% of the energy to Germany. All right. So that's a huge thing. You know, I mean, Germany is a very important country. It's dislocation or whatever. I mean, canceling China. I mean, oh my God. I mean, we would not have cell phones next year. I mean, it would just be a total dislocation of the economy. So, I mean, but that's kind of what I'm saying. Like, you know, China, correct me if I'm wrong, China has not forcefully condemned the action.
No, you're right.
That has been taken to Ukraine.
You're right.
So, okay. So they're kind of both sidesing it because, you know, we could say Russia could start turning those pipelines around and supplying resources, energy resources to China and be its kind of little brother, very little brother in this case. Who knows? Maybe they're waiting and seeing. Maybe they'll come in later. But it's these kinds of situations where there's ambiguity. Like, I mean, I would say this, if the lesson China learned was you can just do it and get away with it, then we literally have a world war on our hands.
This is fascinating. I mean, because then Putin would be the kind of model for the Chinese man to rise and to assume his position as a man in the world and say, I can take whatever I want. I'm entitled to all this. This would be a Chinese male renaissance caused by Putin.
Yeah. And these are how these weird things happen. You know, I mean, it's like Serbian nationalist assassinating, you know, Ferdinand. It's just these weird little dynamics. And then there are these bigger geostrategic issues that haven't been solved. And there's a domino effect or a cascading effect where they kind of eventually get solved. And it's like the Tsar mobilizes and then basically Germany announces the Schlieffenplan. So they had a war plan for a war in Europe that was literally the war plan of a dead man that they just like pulled out of the folder and just be like, all right, this is what we're doing. And it just, next thing you know, you have a continental catastrophe on your hands, ostensibly due to some Serbian lunatic. There are big geostrategic questions in the air. Taiwan's one of them. What's the economic system going to be? This Chimerica relationship of the past 30 years, does China want to continue that? Or does it want to kind of go to a new stage? All of these things are very real. And something like Russia being like, we want Ukraine back, you know, come back. That could launch a world war. I don't think I'm being histrionic by saying this. I think I'm being historic, in fact. This is a very real possibility.
Yes. Two comments left before I let you go. Bardamu, I won't read your super chat, but thanks for the support. Stephen Robinson is asking about the Jewishness of Zelensky. Does that play here? Where is Israel standing? Because it was very easy to see where Israel stood in conflicts of the Middle East with the kind of expansionist and imperialistic attitude toward Muslim nations. Where is Israel here?
I don't know where Israel is. I don't know if I have not, they, this is not really in their bailiwick exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a question I haven't really thought of, to be honest. Obviously, look, Zelensky is Jewish. You can take this as evidence of this decadent West, you know, in Kiev that the Russians must destroy or whatever. I mean, that's not what they're saying. They're claiming that they're Nazis, by the way, but that's kind of how the right-wing Twitter has taken this issue.
Yeah.
I would say this. Maybe I'm buying into the propaganda, and I don't want to, of him staying in Kiev. I believe that he is in Kiev. I don't think that's a lie. Maybe some of the photographs are staged, probably. But he has shown bravery. I mean, I don't know what to say. I mean, look, I think there's a kind of tendency to see Jews as in our sphere, you know, to see Jews as kind of weak and silly and just tedious. You know, they're just a bunch of, all they care about is money and whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't think they would have occupied a territory for multiple decades if all they cared about was money and, you know, going to the nightclub, you know, after dinner. I mean, they obviously have chutzpah, balls, cojones, and they do. And to underestimate them or to misunderstand them is wrong. And Zelensky, again, maybe, look, again, lots of propaganda in war. So maybe we'll learn this was all a farce and he's actually in New York City right now. I don't think that's the case. But at the very least, you can say, I mean, look, he's got balls. He's being tough. He's apparently a willing to die. I mean, it is what it is. Don't call him a little ninny.
But he's an actor, and he seems to be acting himself into his own death. That's and to a certain extent, there's something dangerous about this, because he seems to be choosing the death of much civilians that he could save. I mean, there would have been a strategy of Ukraine here to say, all right, we're not going to engage in urban warfare. We're going to give you a Napoleon-style army versus army fight. It's going to be outside of Kiev and leave our... And I'm sure the Vladimir Putin wouldn't want a single civilian building to be affected. But they chose urban warfare. They chose resistance, which is totally legitimate. I mean, it's a sovereign choice, but he has risked the lives of many people by doing so.
Including himself. I mean, look, it is what it is. I mean, I agree, you know, me as an American who lives in Montana, I can say things like, look, why don't we just neutralize Ukraine? Let's get a deal here. No one needs to die, right? You get Ukraine. Maybe there's like an EU kind of sort of, you're part of the EU. So we get a little something, you get something, we're all happy. I can say that, but again, it's human nature to want to win. And you know, if someone invades your house, you shoot them. I mean, I don't know what to say. It's just, maybe it's horrible. It's a failing of human nature, you could say, that it's going to cause more death, which it surely will. But it is what it is.
Absolutely. Richard, I'm so reassured by tonight's discussion, because I was really scared as you were coming here, because I saw on your Twitter account that you have the Ukraine flag, the Ukraine colors here. And I was thinking, oh shit, I'm going to have to argue against my friend who's going to talk to me about the ghost of Kiev and and the Snake Island. But what you delivered tonight is a very reasonable position, with which I agree with much of what we heard. So it didn't become the debate I thought it would become. I was all ready to debunk the ghost of Kiev.
No. Yeah, I guess, yeah. I'll dye my hair blue next time and start screeching about Hitler.
Our survey question tonight was, what does Putin want? Six people answered all of Ukraine. One person said just a land bridge to Crimea. Two people said half of Ukraine. It certainly looks like the short-term goal here is half of Ukraine. And depending on what happens with the Belarus forces coming from the north may try to actually blockade the entire western border of Ukraine or a large extent of it. So we'll see what happens with this. But if Putin doesn't stop the provisioning, military provisioning by the West, he's going to be facing a much bigger problem in a week, in a month from now, right?
Yeah, it's definitely.
All right. Well, Richard, thank you so much for coming tonight. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Very good discussion. Glad to take part.
Bye-bye. Thank you.